Imagine people will be coming and maybe most of you going over the next 45 minutes. We'll see. If you don't know me, I'm Tim Willis. I teach here at Pepperdine. I have for the last 28 years now. I had a couple students this semester who came to me quietly and said, "Do you remember so-and-so with my last name that you taught here 24 years ago?" Oh, yeah, I'm afraid I do. It's been that long. Yeah. So, I don't know how many of you were. A year ago, I taught one class on Ruth. And so, some of what you're going to see and hear will be duplicating that a little bit, but not a whole lot. This classroom at this time, today, tomorrow, and Friday, we'll have people dealing with Ruth. I'll be here today and tomorrow, and then someone else on Friday. Jared, is that right? Yeah. You want to introduce yourself for Friday? Tell us what we have in store?
My name is Jared Robinson. I teach at the Southern Hills Church of Christ in Abilene, Texas. So the basic structure of these classes is you have a scholar for 2 days, and then you've got a preacher on Friday that would say, taking all of this into account, this is how I would go about preaching a series on the Book of Ruth.
Oh, so great. That's what great. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, what I'm going to be doing is probably not giving you something you haven't already picked up on, but from a so-called scholarly perspective, giving you more information in a couple of ways and looking at the story of Ruth that will emphasize, maybe highlight some things, bring some more clarity to some aspects of these stories that maybe you hadn't recognized. Maybe you did. I don't know. But I don't think I'm going to be giving you any huge insights here. But again, I hope I can bring some clarity. Now, here's what I'm planning to do is, if you're paying attention to the wording of the titles, today it's Ruth and Boaz, and tomorrow it's Boaz and Ruth. And that's because today, really, really deep here. Today I'm going to be focusing on Ruth and kind of coming at things from a woman's perspective, which I'm an expert in. But actually, what I'm going to do is I'm planning to talk for about maybe 30 minutes, and then I'm going to open it up, and I'm going to particularly look to the ladies in the audience to help me out. It seems like every time that I've taught on Ruth, there's always some women in the audience who have taught this class in a series, sometimes a year-long series, in their church. So I want to kind of, frankly, set things up and then see what the women can teach us men. Then tomorrow, I'm going to come back and focus on the Boaz side of the story. That's something I know a little bit more about. And say some stuff to the men tomorrow, what we should be learning from the story of Ruth and Boaz. I'll save that for tomorrow. I started to just pop out with one. We have two heroes, at least, in this story. Both Ruth and Boaz are very, very heroic, noble characters living among the peasants. just a very, very fascinating story. Let's see. Yeah, I think that's enough to get us going here. Just in general. Okay, as we kind of ease into this today, we were introduced to Ruth a little bit last night. Rick Mars was telling us this is the easiest one to teach on. It basically teaches itself. I taught a class for some Pepperdine students here a year ago. I broke them up and had them read the book, thinking, oh, this will take up our first hour. It took 20 minutes. You can read the book out loud in 20 minutes. And so that tells you how short it is, and yet it's so, so rich. But talk about hermeneutics just for a second, just to show you what I think I'm doing here. In my mind, hermeneutics is a fancy word for saying how do you take the biblical text and apply it to modern, current issues, situations, whatever. How do you interpret? All right, and I compare it to real estate. Instead of location, 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 it's context, context, context. And by that I mean the immediate literary context. If you're looking at one sentence or one paragraph, how do they say it? How does it fit within its immediate literary context? And we're going to be focusing primarily, but not entirely, on stuff from the fourth chapter of Ruth. So, you know, we could spend a whole bunch of time talking about what really does it say in Ruth chapter 4. That's one context. The second context, which is what we're really focusing on, I'm going to be focusing on today and tomorrow, is the cultural context. How does understanding the background from the Bible and the rest of the ancient Near East help us to get more clarity in what's going on, the events that are taking place, and what the people in the story are saying? So we're going to be focusing on cultural context. And then the other thing that we could talk about is how does this fit in? What does it have, and how does it add to all of Scripture, the canonical context, the theological context? Because I think one of the problems that we have, and it's something that we've inherited from every generation of Bible readers, is what I have here. I like to talk about alliteration. We have the propensity to privilege preferred passages. And so, you know, I could ask you, if I ask you about the book of Ruth, what verse would come to mind? Wherever you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. All right. Yeah, that's so as if that is the theology of the book of Ruth. No, you need to read that to then its context. And we'll talk a little bit about the context of Ruth within the whole Bible, because I just finished my usual survey class, and one of the last classes was on Ezra and Nehemiah. I posed the question, we discussed it. What would happen if Ezra had been living in Bethlehem in the days of Ruth and Boaz? And those of you, I'll bring that up again here in a minute. But it's those kind of things you have to think about when you're studying. And so we have this propensity to privilege a specific verse that really speaks to us and ignore the context. So we're trying to understand context so that we will be better interpreters and users and appliers of God's Word. All right? So, I'll start off with this, a very personal story from my late grandmother who passed away, we're at it 20 years now, 20 years ago. But remember, toward the end of her life, she lived up until her 90s. She was born in Oklahoma Territory. All right? And but one of the stories that she told, I won't tell the whole story, it would take too long, but one of the stories she told involved how when she was a little girl, she heard her mother telling a story about how my grandmother's older brother had died at birth and been buried. And one of the details of the story stood out to my grandmother. She said, "Mama, whenever you talk about that story, you never mention Daddy. Why not?" And she said, "Because he wasn't there." "What do you mean he wasn't there?" "Well, he was in jail down in Texas." "What?" "Yeah, he had gone down there to do some business and something had happened and so they had thrown him into jail." "Well, what happened?" "Well, my daddy and his brother went down there. It just so happens that while they were down there, the courthouse caught on fire and burned down. And all the records related to your daddy's case were lost, and so they had to let him go. But it was while he was away that your old brother was stillborn, and we buried him. And I said, Grandmother, how can that be? You saying that my great grandfather was guilty of some crime, but he got off because? And she just said, "Honey, they just did things different back then." Well, that's something we need to keep in mind. That doesn't mean that people were different. We've always been creatures made in the image of God, but at different times, different circumstances, different, you know, periods in human history, they've done things different. And we need to be aware of that. Okay, and so that's when we're talking about cultural context. Back in those days, they did things different. I mean, even at the start of the book of Ruth, they have to set the context for you to tell you, oh, this was back in the days of the judges, when the judges judged. Which tells me that it's a little bit different time and place than even the person writing the story of Ruth, whoever that is. Now, one of the things that's important to understand about that culture at that time, in that place in Israel, is the importance of names. Do you have a name? Well, of course, everyone has a name. Oh, but do you have a name? What does that mean? See, in Ruth chapter 4, the reason why Ruth needs to marry and bear a child is to maintain the name of Naomi's and Ruth's dead husband. Maintain the name. So what are they talking about? All right. First of all, a person's name, when they're talking about someone's name, yeah, you're given a name by your parents, but if you have a name, that means basically what we would say is you have rights. So we think every single person has rights. Back then, it's a little different. Even though everyone's made in the image of God, certain people have rights. They have a name. And it's very, very important that you either have a name or you be attached to someone who has a name. Because with a name comes, first of all, reputation. Oh, yeah, he's known for this, she's known for that. So that's a part of having a name. What are you known for? What are you remembered for? But in the story of Ruth, what's really important is what rights to property do you have? You see, if you're living in Israel and you want to have property, you've got to have a name. Your name has to be, quote, you know, written in the book, so to speak, or kept, however they kept those records. So you've got to have a name. How do you get a name? Well, you've got to inherit the name. You see, you are carrying on someone's name. And it's a, boy, it gets really kind of complicated here because these things can shift. They can shift. One person's name can split into two names. If, you know, there's enough strength, if you will, in their descendants. Sociologists, social anthropologists talk about this in kinship-based cultures today. You go to places in Africa, you go to places in Southern Asia, East Asia, you will find these kinship-based cultures, and there's a point. Your name can be a very, very important thing. So notice here, back in the book of Numbers. Numbers has a listing of names. Particularly at the beginning of the chapter, at the beginning of the book, and then in Numbers chapter 26. In Numbers chapter 26, it talks about all 12 tribes and the names of the clans, and then it says, according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. In other words, people who have names in this list, they shall inherit. So, you know, we think, well, you know, if you leave your family and you go off someplace, well, you can, you know, establish yourself somewhere. You get a job, you buy a house. You couldn't do that in this society. You couldn't just go and do that. In order to own property, you have to be able to attach yourself in some way to someone who already has property, who has a name. Yeah.
Was this also tied up into the returning of the property for the year of Jubilee?
For the year of Jubilee, yeah. Yeah. And so they would be probably going back either orally or in writing, looking back at the records of whose name is on the list. And, you know, and how they kept the list, and as we'll see, one of the threats is that your name would be cut off. I mean, you talk about a threat to someone. If you do this, you will be cut off from the people. Your name will be cut off. In other words, the people, with God over them, will not include you in those who have names. There's so many implications to this. Now think about, is your name written in the book of life? That sort of thing. Or will you have an inheritance? Well, we could go on and on and on. But you got to have your name. And then Jesus, the name above all names. See, one of the things I've come to realize, I need to study this even more, is the central significance of inheritance in this culture. In ways that we just don't recognize anymore. It's just not a part of our culture, but it's very, very much a part of theirs. Inheritance is just such a central thing. See, so of utmost importance was inheritance. All right? You remember the story of Naboth? 1 Kings 21. In the days of Elijah and King Ahab. Remember this story? But what is it that Ahab wants to do? What is his offer to Naboth?
To buy his field.
Yeah, let me buy your vineyard. Let me buy your field. I will give you a better one. But I want your vineyard because it's right next to mine, and I just want to expand. I'll trade you for a better... You can trade up for this. And Naboth says, no way. The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. It may be the scrawniest little place in this part of the country, but it's ours. I have an obligation because of the name here. I have an obligation to the generations before me and the generations yet to come to maintain our name here. So the Lord forbid that I should give you, even though you're the king, offering me better land, it's not our land. And so there's no way I'm going to give it to you. And that doesn't make any sense to us, but that just shows you the value of this. I have a brother who works with the churches in American Samoa. I got to visit there once, and I took these pictures, and I said, David, what is going on here? What are these things? He says, oh, that's the family grave. You drive around in American Samoa, and you'll see out in the front yard the grave site for the family, because that's where the family has been for generations and where it plans to be for generations to come. So we ain't moving. I don't care who you are. This is our family's. Our name is here. This is who you are. Yeah. And I mean, look at the passages that talk about sleeping with your fathers. So such and such king died and he slept with his fathers. That's because they had burial places like this. Yeah.
In Proverbs 22, verse 1, it says, a good name is more desirable than great riches.
Yeah, a good name is more desirable than great riches. And I mean, if you're maintaining land, the name, yeah, mm-hmm. That's all you do.
Yeah, if you have a good name, even if you lose riches, you have a good name, you can.
Yeah. So yeah, we're such a mobile people, and you know, such a pull yourself by your own bootstrap sort of thinking. We don't understand this thing. But the more I look at it, the more I go, wow, I just now beginning to understand these people, how significant this is for them. So, notice, Here's the concern in Ruth chapter 4. If you're going to buy this property, Boaz, talking to the other closer kinsmen, says, now, okay, you can buy this property from Ruth, from Naomi, if you want to. But realize that when you do, you've also got to get Ruth in order to do what? To maintain the name of the dead on his inheritance. Oh, see? There are responsibilities that go with rights. There's a concept. There are responsibilities. And the responsibility here is we are maintaining this name. We are maintaining this inheritance. And it might cost me. We'll talk more about this tomorrow. It might cost me to do this, but I'm willing to do it because this, like you're reading, is more precious than riches. Yeah.
So her first child would really, it would to everyone legally, would be her Naomi's son's child.
Exactly.
Well, all right. Let me see. Is this where I want to do this? Let me get into it. Yeah. No, but you're. This is where I want to go. This is where I want to go. All right. So first of all, notice that with property, you've got benefits and you've got responsibilities. You have burdens. They thought of family as equivalent with business. Talk about a family business. Every family was its own business, so to speak, because you were looking around at your family saying, who's going to do the work? And if we don't have enough people to do the work, you know, if we have work that needs to be done, we don't have the people, how are we going to get more? Have kids, hire, you know, transients, someone who doesn't have their own property or cooperate with other parts of the family. That was the usual thing. Yeah. So your cousins and all would pitch in. But anyway, this is where you got your long-term security. If you wanted to know that you were set for a long time, you have good property. But if you're not working that property, if you're not producing stuff off that land, then your cousins and uncles and whatever are going to come down on you and say, hey, we need the produce that comes from this place. If you're not going to do it, we're going to shuffle the deck here a little bit because we need to be as productive as possible. We're just here in California. You guys know we're just coming out of a, I don't know how many year-long drought. But boy, we have it easy compared to these folks. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're in this part, geographically, they're in a place where you can't irrigate. If you want to, you know, water the fields, you got to put it in some kind of skins and carry it up hills and whatever and dump it. Oh, it's hard work. You can't just run canals and stuff. So, you know, and so they are very, very concerned about producing what they can to store it up so that they have stuff in case of those dry years. So, again, very important. So, you have to justify maintaining your ownership by being able to work and produce what they call usufruct. You're able to produce fruit. And that the land, if you can't do that, they will find reasons to redistribute your land. Now, that will be done within the family, within the clan, but still, you know, that's what they would do. So, males, the guys, were responsible for protecting and providing for the family, and I say especially the females. But just because of the way things are set up, that means the females are especially dependent on males who will feel and fulfill the familial obligation to take care of them. And it's kind of a circular thing. That they will take care of the females because the females, put it bluntly, provide workers for the future. All right, that's a big consideration here. So inheritance becomes a huge, huge deal for these people. But look at the handout that I gave you, and you can see, starting with these Middle Assyrian laws, at the bottom of it, the first page, but I'm not going to take the time to read all of these. You can just read through these. They're a little bit complicated. I have to read them 3 or 4 times before I remember what's going on here. They're very wordy and stuff. But essentially, they're saying, okay, who's going to get the inheritance? And in particular in these laws, if you have a widow, what is she going to get? Well, it depends on whether she has any kids and whether her husband's brothers are still alive and have they divided the inheritance from their own father yet. And on the ifs and the ands and the buts go. But the bottom line is, who gets the inheritance and how much of it is. So notice how, I mean, we hear about these things, and I just don't think about them that much, but notice things that happen at marriages. There's an exchange of money, goods, property sometimes. And, you know, I kind of wonder, I don't really know why they have all of these. But, for example, the two main things are bride price and dowry. A groom, get this, a groom gives something to his father-in-law when he gets married. Why? Some people think, well, maybe he's compensating his father-in-law for the work that the daughter would have given if she had stayed in the family. Maybe. Maybe it's just a way of saying, this is how much I value your daughter. I just want to show you I'm really serious about it. And maybe something else. All we know is they did. And it's hard to find an example of a marriage where it didn't happen. At the same time, the father, the bride's father, gives goods and money to his daughter. You get that? To his daughter. And she holds it in order to pass it on to her son. Now, if something happens before she has sons, then there's a question of, well, does it go back to her father? Does it go to her husband? Does it? They have laws dealing with it. Again, just showing you how important all that is. So you can read these laws and see the different examples. Look at this one, just to show you a modern example. I brought this in last year. I still find it very, very interesting. We know about the genocide that happened in Rwanda a little over 20 years ago now. I think it was 94 or 95, something like that. Fascinating to see the people who have gone in after that to see what they run into, what issues come up. And in particular, what comes up is you got a lot more widows now. They said the statistics show that in the wake of the genocide, a third of Rwandan families were headed by widows. Wow. And that's when the fact that widows were kind of third or fourth person down the totem pole usually on inheritance, oh, wow. They're, you start seeing ways that the guys who are left who want to enrich themselves now at the expense of these women who have lost their husbands, they start trying to manipulate laws or use intimidation to keep these women from being able to continue. So, but I find it interesting in here. For example, I put a star by a part of this. Right after footnote 17, under the customary ideal, women were not left unprotected. This is on the back of the handout. A daughter lived and was provided for on her father's land. See, a daughter was taken care of by her father. And after marriage, she lived and was provided on her husband's land. All right? If a woman became widowed, she was granted the right to use her husband's land until her sons became old enough to inherit the land. And then here we go. If a woman became widowed without having borne her husband any children, she was denied any rights to her husband's land unless she married one of his brothers. At which point, that brother became the new owner of the land. Now, kind of your question before. Here's an interesting thing that scholars cannot figure out. According to the Leveret, what we call Leveret law, which is the brother-in-law law, which is on your handout, Deuteronomy 25. It says, so if a man dies and, leaving his widow and they don't have any kids yet, what are you supposed to do? The widow is supposed to marry a brother-in-law. And then when they have children, the first child born of that union is to be considered the child of the husband who died, the man who died. And that's what Ruth is all about, right? And they say that that's in order to maintain the name of the dead man. Now, here's the curious thing. We cannot find a single example in Scripture where, when this happens, the name of the dead man is carried on in the genealogy. I mean, take the case of Ruth and Boaz. Who is it? Mahlon, I think, is Ruth's first husband.
Yeah.
All right. You're supposed to be carrying on his name and the name of his father, Elimelech. But if you look in the genealogy, it's Boaz. So we wonder, did times change that? Are they simply talking about the property being kept intact in some way? We don't know. It's just a curious question. But the idea is keep this name going. So, again, here in Rwanda, we see the same principles going on. Now, I want to move on because I want to give you ladies a little bit of time here. So, what is her value? If property is being passed on from father to son to grandson, there's the only exception is if there aren't any boys, then you can pass it on to your daughter as long as your daughter marries within certain lineage restrictions, because you want to keep this stuff intact in the tribe. So what does a woman bring? Well, number one, she brings children, which is going to keep things going. Someone to inherit from the father. She brings the dowry from her father, from the groom's father-in-law. All right, so that's what she contributes, which is also going to be used by her son. Right? You hope that there are good relations made between these two families, and so if things go south and maybe they need some help, that maybe she can call on her brothers and father and uncles or whatever to help whenever her husband gets into trouble. Someone who's got his back, part of his posse, so to speak. All right. Now, she might also do some work. She might manufacture something. She might, as we see in Proverbs 31, she might go out and do some trading in town. So there's different things she can do. And then, of course, cooking, making clothing, doing other things, supporting the family. But notice how the main concern is the husband, his name, keeping that going. All right? Now, in the case of Ruth, see, here's what, it's a great thing. I don't have to explain the story. If I were in a class here at Pepperdine with so many of my students, I would have to get them to get to know the story. You guys know the story. So think about Ruth here. What does she contribute? And at the same time, what does she cost? I remember, Naomi's about to sell property. Boaz goes to the closer redeemer and says, hey, you want to get this? And the guy says, sure. But then when Boaz says, and then, of course, you're going to also be taking Ruth and having a child by her, right? Oh, I can't do that. Why? Because that might damage, the word is destroy, my inheritance. See, the cost of keeping up the dead man's property at the same time as keeping up his own property might overextend this person so that he can't do it. And he ends up ruining himself. He gets overextended. And so he says, I can't do it. But Boaz says, then I will. Yeah.
I'm sorry to keep going. Yeah. I was wondering, in a case of the brother-in-law law, is the brother-in-law who marries her allowed more than one wife?
That's a great question. We don't know. We assume, yes, back in these days. When you get down to rabbinic law, they say, we know that it says you're supposed to do this, but if the brother-in-law is already married, what he does is he officially divorces the widow so that she's free to marry someone else.
So he stands instead of the dead husband in order to free her.
In order to free her, yes. Yeah.
We just clarifies the danger for the kinsman redeemer then is that he would fail his responsibilities to his own family and they would eject
him. Yeah, to his own land and property, what he has inherited.
Yeah.
You know, from either the same father or maybe grandfather or whatever. Yeah. So he's concerned about that.
About his family.
And you know, so what is it going to take for him to be able to work and be have productivity from this land? It's a cost, because you're going to have to either, I'm assuming they can only support so many workers. Well, can those workers who've now been working, say, 10 acres, can they manage 20? Or would that be such that you'd end up with 20 bad acres rather than 10 good and 10 foul, you know?
Right. Okay.
So, and especially when you get in times of droughts and stuff, and what do you have to do to keep the land up? No telling. Now, so notice, she is not bringing a dowry with her. So when the time comes and the sons that are born, when you're supposed to pass on something for them to inherit, now you're going to have to take it from Boaz's income rather than having a secondary income from Ruth's father, like most families have. See, you're at an economic disadvantage. What about the possibility of having allies from the wife's family? You don't have any. Because she's not from around here. You see? So what she is bringing compared to other potential wives is minimal. All she's got is her hand. What she can work, what work she can do. And what's that? And then there's, after all, she's a foreigner. Now remember Ezra 9? I don't know if we talk about this much anymore, but Ezra 9, Ezra and the people look around and they say, hey, what's going on here? We've got a lot of Jewish people here who are marrying non-Jews. Deuteronomy chapter 7 says don't do that because they might cause you to worship their gods. Can you trust her? If things get kind of dicey, is she going to be on our side? Or might she feel a greater loyalty to someone? Or might she say, hey, this ain't my fight? So you got all those kind of considerations. Yes, sir?
I think she proved her trust by listening and following her mother-in-law and coming, and he recognized that, and she had already proven herself to be basically an adopted Jew.
Yeah. She has convinced Boaz. You wonder, has she convinced the other redeemer? Has she, we don't know how much interaction she's having with all the different people in the community in Bethlehem. And frankly, it's kind of human nature. No matter how long someone has been there, I mean, you go to some rural communities and they'll say, "Oh yeah, well he moved here 40 years ago, so he's not really from here." I mean, go back to American Samoa. One of the elders in my brother's church has lived in this part of Samoa all of his life, lived on the same property, but it's not in his name. He has been leasing it from the person who owns it. When this elder's mother passed away, he wanted to bury his mother there in front of the house that he was leasing, and the owner said, "No way. Even though you've been here 40 years, you have to go back where you came from to bury your mother." So, you wonder if that's going on. I want to go on because I want to hear from the ladies here real quick. So, notice what Ruth does do. Notice how supportive she is of Naomi. The more I look at this, the more I think, wow! She has no reason to. She should have been like Orpah and gone back to her own people. But she didn't. And I wonder, why? Why? It's a foolish thing. We talk about taking a risk. Talk about sticking your neck out. Talk about making yourself vulnerable. Oh, that's what she's doing. So,
But throughout the story, she is pledging her loyalty, her devotion, her support to her mother-in-law from another country. Wow. For a people who are so dependent on having their place being a part of the name of where they are living, she's way out there. She's way out there. Alright? So, in my mind, what this does is, here's where it clarifies, it highlights something that we might not pick up on, is that the overarching quality that I see in Ruth is her self-sacrifice. Her self-sacrifice. I wonder if there isn't a strong bit of Christ-likeness in her in this. Think about it. God is a little foreign in humanity. Even though he comes into his own don't receive him. But he's willing to do it. Wow. Yeah. So you surpass them all. So here's where I wanted to get 10 minutes ago. So tell me, ladies, tell me about self-sacrifice. How much is that a part of your experience? And in what ways have you seen it exemplified? Maybe not by yourself, but maybe by your mother, an aunt. If I had more time, I'd tell you about Emily Pownall, who just passed away a few weeks ago at our church. Beautiful, beautiful lady.
She was the same way in Italy. On the field with her three sons.
Tell me about it.
Beautiful husband.
What? Give me an example. Self-sacrifice.
She let us come there and be with them, part of the family. And when Tommy was drowning in the Lago di Riva, they came up, and Kimmy and Johnny Caden saved him. What actually happened, Tommy had an epileptic fit, and it saved him. But he spent the night in the hospital. They came back to the camp, they were in Torino, and the first thing they said, hey, Tommy, you want to go swimming? And if you know Mount Tommy, you know him when he's asleep. That guy was goofy. She's
amazing, just amazing. Giving up time.
And she was kind of like the mother hen for all of us young missionaries on our lovely wife.
You marvel at how much they do.
That's true. So little.
And they make so much of it.
Well, I'm going to say this as humbly as I can, that I'm a Lisa widow with three kids. And my husband and I served on the mission field for 14 years. And then we were married 32. And I'm glad I got in marriage with him through in ministry. He was full-time in ministry. And there are a lot of sacrifices women make so that men can fulfill a calling that they believe God is calling them to. Sacrifices that sometimes we don't even speak of some. And, but after losing my husband, my reflection of God was, who am I now? And I had desires maybe to, you know, further my education. But my education came in a form of raising children, which I have no regret of. God bless this with life. But being a homemaker and a wife and supportive for, you know, the silent partner, if you will. I don't know if it's Satan or just your own personal reflection. My own personal reflection is, you know, did I make the right choice now that I am, you know, myself? You know, and what did God do with me while he was working on us kind of thing, you know. So the sacrifices that, I know men make them too, but women make them in different ways. And men, I mean, he had the PhD and he had the credentials. They get you hired, you know, and the retired wife or whatever in ministry, it's just a whole other journey. And where do you find yourself? In the Lord's body? When you know you were hired, your husband was hired for a job, and when he's gone, where is your place?
What is your identity?
What is your identity? Where does it lie? And I know that it is with God as it is with all of us. But those are very real, hard questions.
See, I think about what the women said after Obed was born to Ruth. What do? They go around congratulating Naomi. What is Ruth doing?
You mentioned the comparing the character of Ruth with Christ. I really think that Ruth is us as Christians. Ruth showed an immense amount of faith in Naomi, and considered her marriage to Naomi's son to be transformative, and it divorced her from who she used to be. So unlike her co-sister-in-law, she did not return to whence she came, because she was no longer part of that. Just like as when we become Christians, we are no longer part of the world. And so to me, looking at Ruth, it's like God has given us, not just as women, but as Christians, an example that we can follow in how much it can cost us, but also how much the riches are, and the fact that he has provided for us a kinsman redeemer that redeems us.
One last thing about Emily.
Yeah.
We happened to be at their place when Mal was passing away. And the thing that he said was, Emily and I were a good team.
Mm-hmm. And they were. One more, and then we're out of time here. So, Gary?
Ruth had no idea that her great grandson would be the famous king. She had no idea of that. And so he was a foreigner in a strange land. But because she gave herself to the God of Naomi, God can use her. And she never saw or understood that her lineage is in the line of the Messiah.
Yeah, and boy, there's another whole lesson. If I had a third day, I might go there. Because you guys know this, right? Who was, at least according to the genealogy, who was Boaz's parent? Rahab, and the guy named some fishy guy named Salmon.
It's great, great, great man.
Yeah. So there's this. So again, I wonder what kind of self-sacrificial lives these women were living, and from that, what do the descendants learn? Yeah.
You know, there was something about Naomi for Ruth to want to follow her, but then at the end of chapter 1, Naomi says, I left full and I returned empty. What is Ruth?
I know.
Look what Ruth did for her. And she's saying, I returned empty, but yet Ruth stayed with her and loved her.
Yeah. Naomi says she's empty, and Ruth is less than empty because she has less than Naomi to make any claims on. Wow. Hey, thank you guys. We're over time. Thank you.
Thank you.